Chapter 5. Maps in the Brain. It took years for us to deduce that reference frames exist throughout the neocortex, but in hindsight, we could have understood this a long time ago with a simple observation. Right now, I am sitting in a small lounge area of Numenta's office. Near me are three comfortable chairs, similar to the one I am sitting in. Beyond the chairs are several freestanding desks. Beyond the desks, I see the old county courthouse across the street. Light from these objects enters my eyes and is projected onto the retina. Cells in the retina convert light into spikes. This is where vision starts, at the back of the eye. Why, then, do we not perceive objects as being in the eye? If the chairs, desks, and courthouse are imaged next to each other on my retina, how is it that I perceive them to be at different distances and different locations? Similarly, if I hear a car approaching, why do I perceive the car as 100 feet away to my right, and not in my ear, where the sound actually is? This simple observation that we perceive objects as being somewhere, not in our eyes and ears, but at some location out in the world, tells us that the brain must have neurons whose activity represents the location of every object that we perceive. At the end of the last chapter, I told you that we were worried about submitting our first paper about reference frames, because at that time, we didn't know how neurons in the neocortex could do this. We were proposing a major new theory about how the neocortex works, but the theory was largely based on logical deduction. It would be a stronger paper if we could show how neurons did it. The day before we submitted, I added a few lines of text, suggesting that the answer might be found in an older part of the brain called the entorhinal cortex. I am going to tell you why we suggested that with a story about evolution. An evolutionary tale. When animals first started moving about in the world, they needed a mechanism to decide which way to move. Simple animals have simple mechanisms. For example, some bacteria follow gradients. If the quantity of a needed resource, such as food, is increasing, then they are more likely to keep moving in the same direction. If the quantity is decreasing, then they are more likely to turn and try a different direction. A bacterium doesn't know where it is. It doesn't have any way to represent its location in the world. It just goes forward and uses a simple rule for deciding when to turn. A slightly more sophisticated animal, such as an earthworm, might move to stay within desirable ranges of warmth, food, and water, but it doesn't know where it is in the garden. It doesn't know how far away the brick path is, or the direction and distance to the nearest fence post. Now consider the advantages afforded to an animal that knows where it is, an animal that always knows its location relative to its environment. The animal can remember where it found food in the past and the places it used for shelter. The animal can then calculate how to get from its current location to these and other previously visited locations. The animal can remember the path it traveled to the watering hole and what happened at various locations along the way. Knowing your location and the location of other things in the world has many advantages, but it requires a reference frame. Recall that a reference frame is like the grid of a map. For example, on a paper map, you might locate something using labeled rows and columns, such as row D and column 7. The rows and columns of a map are a reference frame for the area represented by the map. If an animal has a reference frame for its world, then as it explores, it can note what it found at each location. When the animal wants to get someplace, such as a shelter, it can use the reference frame to figure out how to get there from its current location. Having a reference frame for your world is useful for survival. Being able to navigate the world is so valuable that evolution discovered multiple methods for doing it. For example, some honeybees can communicate distance and direction using a form of dance. Mammals, such as ourselves, have a powerful internal navigation system. There are neurons in the old part of our brain that are known to learn maps of the places we have visited, and these neurons have been under evolutionary pressure for so long that they are fine-tuned to do what they do. In mammals, the old brain parts where these map-creating neurons exist are called the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex. In humans, these organs are roughly the size of a finger. There is one set on each side of the brain, near the center. Maps in the old brain. In 1971, scientist John O'Keefe and his student Jonathan Dostrovsky placed a wire into a rat's brain. The wire recorded the spiking activity of a single neuron in the hippocampus. The wire went up toward the ceiling so they could record the activity of the cell as the rat moved and explored its environment, which was typically a big box on a table. They discovered what are now called place cells, neurons that fire every time the rat is in a particular location, in a particular environment. A place cell is like a "you are here" marker on a map. As the rat moves, different place cells become active in each new location. If the rat returns to a location where it was before, the same place cell becomes active again. In 2005, scientists in the lab of Maybrit Moser and Edvard Moser used a similar experimental setup, again with rats. In their experiments, they recorded signals from neurons in the entorhinal cortex, adjacent to the hippocampus. They discovered what are now called grid cells, which fire at multiple locations in an environment. The locations where a grid cell becomes active form a grid pattern. If the rat moves in a straight line, the same grid cell becomes active again and again at equally spaced intervals. The details of how place cells and grid cells work are complicated and still not completely understood, but you can think of them as creating a map of the environment occupied by the rat. Grid cells are like the rows and columns of a paper map, but overlaid on the animal's environment. They allow the animal to know where it is, to predict where it will be when it moves, and to plan movements. For example, if I am at location B4 on a map and want to get to location D6, I can use the map's grid to know that I have to go 2 squares to the right and 2 squares down. But grid cells alone don't tell you what is at a location. For example, if I told you that you were at location A6 on a map, that information doesn't tell you what you will find there. To know what is at A6, you need to look at the map and see what is printed in the corresponding square. Place cells are like the details printed in the square. Which place cells become active depends on what the rat senses at a particular location. Place cells tell the rat where it is based on sensory input, but place cells alone aren't useful for planning movements. That requires grid cells. The two types of cells work together to create a complete model of the rat's environment. Every time a rat enters an environment, the grid cells establish a reference frame. If it is a novel environment, the grid cells create a new reference frame. If the rat recognizes the environment, the grid cells re-establish the previously used reference frame. This process is analogous to you entering a town. If you look around and realize that you have been there before, you pull out the correct map for that town. If the town looks unfamiliar, then you take out a blank piece of paper and start creating a new map. As you walk around the town, you write on your map what you see at each location. This is what grid cells and place cells do. They create unique maps for every environment. As a rat moves, the active grid cells and the active place cells change to reflect the new location. Humans have grid cells and place cells too. Unless you're completely disoriented, you always have a sense of where you are. I am now standing in my office. Even if I close my eyes, my sense of location persists, and I continue to know where I am. Keeping my eyes closed, I take 2 steps to my right, and my sense of location in the room changes. The grid cells and place cells in my brain have created a map of my office, and they keep track of where I am in my office, even when my eyes are closed. As I walk, which cells are active changes to reflect my new location. Humans, rats, indeed all mammals, use the same mechanism for knowing our location. We all have grid cells and place cells that create models of the places we have been. Maps in the new brain. When we were writing our 2017 paper about locations and reference frames in the neocortex, I had some knowledge of place cells and grid cells. It occurred to me that knowing the location of my finger relative to a coffee cup is similar to knowing the location of my body relative to a room. My finger moves around the cup in the same way that my body moves about a room. I realized that the neocortex might have neurons that are equivalent to the ones in the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex. These cortical place cells and cortical grid cells would learn models of objects in a similar way to how place cells and grid cells in the old brain learn models of environments. Given their role in basic navigation, place cells and grid cells are almost certainly evolutionarily older than the neocortex. Therefore, I figured it was more likely that the neocortex creates reference frames using a derivative of grid cells than that it evolved a new mechanism from scratch. But in 2017, we were not aware of any evidence that the neocortex had anything similar to grid cells or place cells. It was informed speculation. Shortly after our 2017 paper was accepted, we learned of recent experiments that suggested grid cells might be present in parts of the neocortex. I will discuss these experiments in Chapter 7. This was encouraging. The more we studied the literature related to grid cells and place cells, the more confident we became that cells that perform similar functions exist in every cortical column. We first made this argument in a 2019 paper titled "A Framework for Intelligence and Cortical Function Based on Grid Cells in the Neocortex." Again, to learn a complete model of something, you need both grid cells and place cells. Grid cells create a reference frame to specify locations and plan movements, but you also need sensed information, represented by place cells, to associate sensory input with locations in the reference frame. The mapping mechanisms in the neocortex are not an exact copy of ones in the old brain. Evidence suggests that the neocortex uses the same basic neural mechanisms, but it is different in several ways. It is as if nature stripped down the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex to a minimal form, made tens of thousands of copies, and arranged them side by side in cortical columns. That became the neocortex. Grid cells and place cells in the old brain mostly track the location of one thing, the body. They know where the body is in its current environment. The neocortex, on the other hand, has about 150,000 copies of this circuit, one per cortical column. Therefore, the neocortex tracks thousands of locations simultaneously. For example, each small patch of your skin and each small patch of your retina has its own reference frame in the neocortex. Your five fingertips touching a cup are like five rats exploring a box. Huge maps in tiny spaces. So, what does a model in the brain look like? How does the neocortex stuff hundreds of models into each square millimeter? To understand how this works, let's go back to our paper map analogy. Say I have a map of a town. I spread it out on a table and see that it is marked with rows and columns dividing it into 100 squares. A1 is the top left and J10 is the bottom right. Printed in each square are things I might see in that part of town. I take a pair of scissors and cut out each square, marking it with its grid coordinates, B6, G1, etc. I also mark each square with Town 1. I then do the same for 9 more maps, each map representing a different town. I now have 1,000 squares, 100 map squares for each of 10 towns. I shuffle the squares and put them in a stack. Although my stack contains 10 complete maps, only one location can be seen at a time. Now, someone blindfolds me and drops me off at a random location in one of the 10 towns. Removing my blindfold, I look around. At first, I don't know where I am. Then I see I am standing in front of a fountain with a sculpture of a woman reading a book. I flip through my map squares, one at a time, until I see one showing this fountain. The map square is labeled Town 3, Location D2. Now I know what town I am in, and I know where I am in that town. There are several things I can do next. For example, I can predict what I will see if I start walking. My current location is D2. If I walk east, I will be in D3. I search my stack of squares to find the square labeled Town 3, D3. It shows a playground. In this way, I can predict what I will encounter if I move in a certain direction. Perhaps I want to go to the town library. I can search my stack of squares until I see one showing a library in Town 3. That square is labeled G7. Given that I am at D2, I can calculate that I have to travel 3 squares east and 5 squares south to get to the library. I can take several different routes to get there. Using my map squares one at a time, I can visualize what I will encounter along any particular route. I choose one that takes me past an ice cream shop. Now, consider a different scenario. After being dropped off at an unknown location and removing my blindfold, I see a coffee shop. But when I look through my stack of squares, I find 5 showing a similar-looking coffee shop. 2 coffee shops are in one town, and the other 3 are in different towns. I could be in any of these 5 locations. What should I do? I can eliminate the ambiguity by moving. I look at the 5 squares where I might be, and then look up what I will see if I walk south from each of them. The answer is different for each of the 5 squares. To figure out where I am, I then physically walk south. What I find there eliminates my uncertainty. I now know where I am. This way of using maps is different than how we typically use them. First, our stack of map squares contains all our maps. In this way, we use the stack to figure out both what town we are in and where we are in that town. Second, if we are uncertain where we are, then we can determine our town and location by moving. This is what happens when you reach into a black box and touch an unknown object with one finger. With a single touch, you probably can't determine what object you are feeling. You might have to move your finger one or more times to make that determination. By moving, you discover 2 things at the same time. The moment you recognize what object you are touching, you also know where your finger is on the object. Finally, this system can scale to handle a large number of maps and do so quickly. In the paper map analogy, I described looking at the map squares one at a time. This could take a lot of time if you had many maps. Neurons, however, use what is called associative memory. The details are not important here, but it allows neurons to search through all the map squares at once. Neurons take the same amount of time to search through 1,000 maps as to search through one. Maps in a cortical column. Now let's consider how map-like models are implemented by neurons in the neocortex. Our theory says that every cortical column can learn models of complete objects. Therefore, every column, every square millimeter of the neocortex, has its own set of map squares. How a cortical column does this is complicated, and we don't yet understand it completely. But we understand the basics. Recall that a cortical column has multiple layers of neurons. Several of these layers are needed to create the map squares. Included in your downloadable PDF is a simplified diagram titled A Model of a Cortical Column to give you a flavor of what we think is happening in a cortical column. This figure represents 2 layers of neurons, the shaded boxes, in one cortical column. Although a column is tiny, about 1 millimeter wide, each of these layers might have 10,000 neurons. The upper layer receives the sensory input to the column. When an input arrives, it causes several hundred neurons to become active. In the paper map analogy, the upper layer represents what you observe at some location, such as the fountain. The bottom layer represents the current location in a reference frame. In the analogy, the lower layer represents a location, such as Town 3, D2, but doesn't represent what is observed there. It is like a blank square, labeled only with Town 3, location D2. The 2 vertical arrows represent connections between the blank map squares, the lower layer, and what is seen at that location, the upper layer. The downward arrow is how an observed feature, such as the fountain, is associated with a particular location in a particular town. The upward arrow associates a particular location, Town 3, D2, with an observed feature. The upper layer is roughly equivalent to place cells, and the lower layer is roughly equivalent to grid cells. Learning a new object, such as a coffee cup, is mostly accomplished by learning the connections between the 2 layers, the vertical arrows. Put another way, an object, such as a coffee cup, is defined by a set of observed features, upper layer, associated with a set of locations on the cup, lower layer. If you know the feature, then you can determine the location. If you know the location, you can predict the feature. The basic flow of information goes as follows. A sensory input arrives and is represented by the neurons in the upper layer. This invokes the location in the lower layer that is associated with the input. When the movement occurs, such as moving a finger, then the lower layer changes to the expected new location, which causes a prediction of the next input in the upper layer. If the original input is ambiguous, such as the coffee shop, then the network activates multiple locations in the lower layer. For example, all the locations where a coffee shop exists. This is what happens if you touch the rim of a coffee cup with one finger. Many objects have a rim, so you can't at first be certain what object you are touching. When you move, the lower layer changes all the possible locations, which then make multiple predictions in the upper layer. The next input will eliminate any locations that don't match. We simulated this two-layer circuit in software using realistic assumptions for the number of neurons in each layer. Our simulations showed that not only can individual cortical columns learn models of objects, but each column can learn hundreds of them. The neural mechanism and simulations are described in our 2019 paper, Locations in the Neocortex, a theory of sensory motor object recognition using cortical grid cells. Orientation. There are other things a cortical column must do to learn models of objects. For example, there needs to be a representation of orientation. Say you know what town you are in, and you know your location in that town. Now, I ask you, what will you see if you walk forward one block? You would reply, which direction am I walking? Knowing your location is not sufficient to predict what you will see when you walk. You also need to know which way you are facing, your orientation. Orientation is also required to predict what you will see from a particular location. For example, standing on a street corner, you might see a library when you face north and a playground when you face south. There are neurons in the old brain called head direction cells. As their name suggests, these cells represent the direction an animal's head is facing. Head direction cells act like a compass, but they aren't tied to magnetic north. They are aligned to a room or environment. If you stand in a familiar room and then close your eyes, you retain a sense of which way you are facing. If you turn your body while keeping your eyes closed, your sense of direction changes. This sense is created by your head direction cells. When you rotate your body, your head direction cells change to reflect your new orientation in the room. Cortical columns must have cells that perform an equivalent function to head direction cells. We refer to them by the more generic term orientation cells. Imagine you're touching the lip of the coffee cup with your index finger. The actual impression on the finger depends on the orientation of the finger. You can, for example, keep your finger in the same location, but rotate it around the point of contact. As you do, the sensation of the finger changes. Therefore, in order to predict its input, a cortical column must have a representation of orientation. For simplicity, I didn't show orientation cells and other details in the previous diagram of a cortical column. To summarize, we proposed that every cortical column learns models of objects. The columns do this by using the same basic method that the old brain uses to learn models of environments. Therefore, we proposed that each cortical column has a set of cells equivalent to grid cells, another set equivalent to place cells, and another set equivalent to head direction cells, all of which were first discovered in parts of the old brain. We came to our hypothesis by logical deduction. In Chapter 7, I will list the growing experimental evidence that supports our proposal. But first, we are going to turn our attention to the neocortex as a whole. Recall that each cortical column is small, about the width of a piece of thin spaghetti, and the neocortex is large, about the size of a dinner napkin. Therefore, there are about 150,000 columns in a human neocortex. Not all of the cortical columns are modeling objects. What the rest of the columns are doing is the topic of the next chapter. Chapter 6. Concepts, Language, and High-Level Thinking. Our superior cognitive functions are what most distinguish us from our primate cousins. Our ability to see and hear is similar to a monkey's, but only humans use complex language, make complex tools such as computers, and are able to reason about concepts such as evolution, genetics, and democracy. Vernon Mountcastle proposed that every column in the neocortex performs the same basic function. For this to be true, then, language and other high-level cognitive abilities are at some fundamental level the same as seeing, touching, and hearing. This is not obvious. Reading Shakespeare does not seem similar to picking up a coffee cup. But that is the implication of Mountcastle's proposal. Mountcastle knew that cortical columns aren't completely identical. There are physical differences, for example, between columns that get input from your fingers and columns that understand language, but there are more similarities than differences. Therefore, Mountcastle deduced that there must be some basic function that underlies everything the neocortex does, not just perception, but all the things we think of as intelligence. The idea that diverse abilities such as vision, touch, language, and philosophy are fundamentally the same is hard for many people to accept. Mountcastle didn't propose what the common function is, and it is hard to imagine what it could be, so it is easy to ignore his proposal or reject it outright. For example, linguists often describe language as different from all other cognitive abilities. If they embraced Mountcastle's proposal, they might look for the commonality between language and vision to better understand language. For me, this idea is too exciting to ignore, and I find that the empirical evidence overwhelmingly supports Mountcastle's proposal. Therefore, we are left with a fascinating puzzle. What kind of function or algorithm can create all aspects of human intelligence? So far, I have described a theory of how cortical columns learn models of physical objects, such as coffee cups, chairs, and smartphones. The theory says that cortical columns create reference frames for each observed object. Recall that a reference frame is like an invisible three-dimensional grid surrounding and attached to something. The reference frame allows a cortical column to learn the locations of features that define the shape of an object. In more abstract terms, we can think of reference frames as a way to organize any kind of knowledge. A reference frame for a coffee cup corresponds to a physical object that we can touch and see. However, reference frames can also be used to organize knowledge of things we can't directly sense. Think of all the things you know that you haven't directly experienced. For example, if you have studied genetics, then you know about DNA molecules. You can visualize their double helix shape. You know how they encode sequences of amino acids using the ATCG code of nucleotides. And you know how DNA molecules replicate by unzipping. Of course, nobody has ever directly seen or touched a DNA molecule. We can't, because they are too small. To organize our knowledge of DNA molecules, we make pictures as if we could see them, and models as if we could touch them. This allows us to store our knowledge of DNA molecules in reference frames, just like our knowledge of coffee cups. We use this trick for much of what we know. For example, we know a lot about photons, and we know a lot about our galaxy, the Milky Way. Once again, we imagine these as if we could see and touch them, and therefore we can organize the facts we know about them using the same reference frame mechanism that we use for everyday physical objects. But human knowledge extends to things that cannot be visualized. For example, we have knowledge about concepts such as democracy, human rights, and mathematics. We know many facts about these concepts, but we are unable to organize these facts in a way that resembles a three-dimensional object. You can't easily make an image of democracy. But there must be some form of organization to conceptual knowledge. Concepts such as democracy and mathematics are not just a pile of facts. We are able to reason about them and make predictions about what will happen if we act one way or another. Our ability to do this tells us that knowledge of concepts must also be stored in reference frames. but these reference frames may not be easily equated to the reference frames we use for coffee cups and other physical objects. For example, it is possible that the reference frames that are most useful for certain concepts have more than three dimensions. We are not able to visualize spaces with more than three dimensions. But from a mathematical point of view, they work the same way as spaces with three or fewer dimensions. All knowledge is stored in reference frames. The hypothesis I explore in this chapter is that the brain arranges all knowledge using reference frames, and that thinking is a form of moving. Thinking occurs when we activate successive locations in reference frames. This hypothesis can be broken down into the following components. 1. Reference frames are present everywhere in the neocortex. This premise states that every column in the neocortex has cells that create reference frames. I have proposed that the cells that do this are similar, but not identical, to the grid cells and place cells found in older parts of the brain. 2. Reference frames are used to model everything we know, not just physical objects. A column in the neocortex is just a bunch of neurons. A column doesn't know what its inputs represent, and it doesn't have any prior knowledge of what it is supposed to learn. A column is just a mechanism built of neurons that blindly tries to discover and model the structure of whatever is causing its inputs to change. Earlier, I posited that brains first evolved reference frames to learn the structure of environments so that we could move about the world. Then our brains evolved to use the same mechanism to learn the structure of physical objects so that we could recognize and manipulate them. I am now proposing that our brains once again evolved to use that same mechanism to learn and represent the structure underlying conceptual objects, such as mathematics and democracy. 3. All knowledge is stored at locations relative to reference frames. Reference frames are not an optional component of intelligence. They are the structure in which all information is stored in the brain. Every fact you know is paired with a location in a reference frame. To become an expert in a field such as history requires assigning historical facts to locations in an appropriate reference frame. Organizing knowledge this way makes the facts actionable. Recall the analogy of a map. By placing facts about a town onto a grid-like reference frame, we can determine what actions are needed to achieve a goal, such as how to get to a particular restaurant. The uniform grid of the map makes the facts about the town actionable. This principle applies to all knowledge. 4. Thinking is a form of movement. If everything we know is stored in reference frames, then to recall stored knowledge, we have to activate the appropriate locations in the appropriate reference frames. Thinking occurs when the neurons invoke location after location in a reference frame, bringing to mind what was stored in each location. The succession of thoughts that we experience when thinking is analogous to the succession of sensations we experience when touching an object with a finger, or the succession of things we see when we walk about a town. Reference frames are also the means for achieving goals. Just as a paper map allows you to figure out how to get from where you are to a desired new location, reference frames in the neocortex allow you to figure out the steps you should take to achieve more conceptual goals, such as solving an engineering problem or getting a promotion at work. Although we mentioned these ideas about conceptual knowledge in some of our published research, they were not the focus, nor have we published papers directly on this topic. So, you could consider this chapter to be more speculative than earlier parts of the book, but I don't feel that way. Although there are many details we don't yet understand, I am confident that the overall framework, that concepts and thinking are based on reference frames, will withstand the test of time. In the rest of this chapter, I will first describe a well-studied feature of the neocortex, its division into what regions and where regions. I use this discussion to show how cortical columns can perform markedly different functions by a simple change to their reference frames. Then I move on to more abstract and conceptual forms of intelligence. I present experimental evidence that supports the aforementioned premises and give examples of how the theory might relate to three topics: mathematics, politics, and language. What and where pathways? Your brain has two vision systems. If you follow the optic nerve as it travels from the eye to the neocortex, you will see that it leads to two parallel vision systems, called the what visual pathway and the where visual pathway. The what pathway is a set of cortical regions that starts at the very back of the brain and moves around to the sides. The where pathway is a set of regions that also starts at the back of the brain but moves up toward the top. The what and where vision systems were discovered over 50 years ago. Years later, scientists realized that similar, parallel pathways also exist for other senses. There are what and where regions for seeing, touching, and hearing. What and where pathways have complementary roles. For example, if we disable the where visual pathway, then a person looking at an object can tell you what the object is, but they can't reach for the object. They know they are seeing a cup, for example, but oddly, they can't say where the cup is. If we then switch it around and disable the what visual pathway, then the person can reach out and grab the object. They know where it is, but they cannot identify what it is. At least, not visually. When their hand touches the object, they can identify the object via touch. Columns in the what and where regions look similar. They have similar cell types, layers, and circuits. So why would they operate differently? What is the difference between a column in a what region and a column in a where region that leads to their different roles? You might be tempted to assume that there is some difference in how the two types of columns function. Perhaps where columns have an additional few types of neurons or different connections between layers. You might admit that what and where columns look similar, but argue that there is probably some physical difference that we just haven't found yet. If you took this position, then you would be rejecting Mountcastle's proposal. But it is not necessary to abandon Mountcastle's premise. We have proposed a simple explanation for why some columns are what columns and some are where columns. Cortical grid cells in what columns attach reference frames to objects. Cortical grid cells in where columns attach reference frames to your body. If a where visual column could talk, it might say, "I have created a reference frame that is attached to the body. Using this reference frame, I look at a hand and know its location relative to the body. I then look at an object and know its location relative to the body. With these two locations, both in the body's reference frame, I can calculate how to move the hand to the object. I know where the object is and how to reach for it, but I can't identify it. I don't know what that object is." If a what visual column could talk, it might say, "I have created a reference frame that is attached to an object. Using this reference frame, I can identify the object as a coffee cup. I know what the object is, but I don't know where it is." Working together, what and where columns allow us to identify objects, reach for them, and manipulate them. Why would one column, column A, attach reference frames to an external object, and another, column B, attach them to the body? It could be as simple as where the inputs to the column come from. If column A gets sensory input from an object, such as sensations from a finger touching a cup, it will automatically create a reference frame anchored to the object. If column B gets input from the body, such as neurons that detect the joint angles of the limbs, it will automatically create a reference frame anchored to the body. In some ways, your body is just another object in the world. The neocortex uses the same basic method to model your body as it does to model objects, such as coffee cups. However, unlike external objects, your body is always present. A significant portion of the neocortex, the where regions, is dedicated to modeling your body and the space around your body. The idea that the brain contains maps of the body is not new. Neither is the idea that movement of the limbs requires body-centric reference frames. The point I want to make is that cortical columns, which look and operate similarly, can appear to perform different functions depending on what their reference frames are anchored to. Given this notion, it is not a big leap to see how reference frames can be applied to concepts. Reference frames for concepts. Up to now in the book, I have described how the brain learns models of things that have a physical shape. Staplers, cell phones, DNA molecules, buildings, and your body all have physical presence. These are all things that we can directly sense, or as in the case of the DNA molecule, can imagine sensing. However, much of what we know about the world can't be sensed directly and may not have any physical equivalent. For example, we can't reach out and touch concepts such as democracy or prime numbers, yet we know a lot about these things. How can cortical columns create models of things that we can't sense? The trick is that reference frames don't have to be anchored to something physical. A reference frame for a concept such as democracy needs to be self-consistent, but it can exist relatively independent of everyday physical things. It is similar to how we can create maps for fictional lands. A map of a fictional land needs to be self-consistent, but it doesn't need to be located anywhere in particular relative to Earth. The second trick is that reference frames for concepts do not have to have the same number or type of dimensions as reference frames for physical objects, such as coffee cups. The locations of buildings in a town are best described in two dimensions. The shape of a coffee cup is best described in three dimensions. But all the abilities we get from a reference frame, such as determining the distance between two locations and calculating how to move from one location to another, are also present in reference frames with four or more dimensions. If you have trouble understanding how something can have more than three dimensions, consider this analogy. Say I want to create a reference frame in which I can organize knowledge about all the people I know. One dimension I might use is age. I can arrange my acquaintances along this dimension by how old they are. Another metric might be where they live relative to me. This would require two more dimensions. Another dimension could be how often I see them or how tall they are. I'm up to five dimensions. This is just an analogy. These would not be the actual dimensions used by the neocortex. But I hope you can see how more than three dimensions could be useful. It is likely that columns in the neocortex don't have a preconceived notion of what kind of reference frame they should use. When a column learns a model of something, part of the learning is discovering what is a good reference frame, including the number of dimensions. Now, I will review the empirical evidence that supports the four premises I listed above. This is an area where there isn't a lot of experimental evidence, but there is some, and it is growing. Method of loci. A well-known trick for remembering a list of items known as the method of loci, or sometimes the memory palace, is to imagine placing the items you want to remember at different locations in your house. To recall the list of items, you imagine walking through your house, which brings back the memory of each item one at a time. The success of this memory trick tells us that recalling things is easier when they are assigned to locations in a familiar reference frame. In this case, the reference frame is the mental map of your house. Notice that the act of recalling is achieved by moving. You are not physically moving your body, but mentally moving through your house. The method of loci supports two of the above premises. Information is stored in reference frames, and retrieval of information is a form of movement. The method is useful for quickly memorizing a list of items, such as a random set of nouns. It works because it assigns the items to a previously learned reference frame, your house, and uses previously learned movements, how you typically move through your house. However, most of the time when you learn, your brain creates new reference frames. We will see an example of that next. Studies of humans using fMRI. fMRI is a technology for looking into a live brain and seeing which parts are most active. You have probably seen fMRI images. They show an outline of a brain with some parts colored yellow and red, indicating where the most energy was being consumed when the image was taken. fMRI is usually used with a human subject because the process requires lying perfectly still inside a narrow tube in a big, noisy machine while doing a specific mental task. Often the subject will be looking at a computer screen while following the verbal instructions of a researcher. The invention of fMRI has been a boon for certain types of research, but for the kind of research we do, it is generally not too useful. Our research on neocortical theory relies on knowing which individual neurons are active at any point in time, and the active neurons change several times a second. There are experimental techniques that provide this kind of data, but fMRI does not have the spatial and temporal precision we typically need. fMRI measures the average activity of many neurons and can't detect activity that lasts less than about a second. Therefore, we were surprised and elated to learn of a clever fMRI experiment performed by Christian Doller, Caswell Berry, and Neil Burgess that showed that grid cells exist in the neocortex. The details are complicated, but the researchers realized that grid cells might exhibit a signature that could be detected using fMRI. They first had to verify that their technique worked, so they looked at the entorhinal cortex, where grid cells are known to exist. They had human subjects perform a navigation task of moving around a virtual world on a computer screen, and using fMRI, they were able to detect the presence of grid cell activity while the subjects were performing the task. They then turned their focus to the neocortex. They used their fMRI technique to look at the frontal areas of the neocortex while the subject performed the same navigation task. They found the same signature, strongly suggesting that grid cells also exist in at least some parts of the neocortex. Another team of scientists, Alexandra Constantinescu, Jill O'Reilly, and Timothy Behrens, used the new fMRI technique for a different task. The subjects were shown images of birds. The birds differed by the length of their necks and the length of their legs. The subjects were asked to perform various mental imagery tasks related to the birds, such as to imagine a new bird that combined features of two previously seen birds. Not only did the experiments show that grid cells are present in frontal areas of the neocortex, but the researchers found evidence that the neocortex stored the bird images in a map-like reference frame. One dimension represented neck length and another represented leg length. The research team further showed that when the subjects thought about birds, they were mentally moving through the map of birds in the same way you can mentally move through the map of your house. Again, the details of this experiment are complex, but the fMRI data suggest that this part of the neocortex used grid cell-like neurons to learn about birds. The subjects who participated in this experiment had no notion that this was happening, but the imaging data were clear. The method of loci uses a previously learned map, the map of your house, to store items for later recall. In the bird example, the neocortex created a new map, a map that was suited for the task of remembering birds with different necks and legs. In both examples, the process of storing items in a reference frame and recalling them via movement is the same. If all knowledge is stored this way, then what we commonly call thinking is actually moving through a space, through a reference frame. Your current thought, the thing that is in your head at any moment, is determined by the current location in the reference frame. As the location changes, the items stored at each location are recalled one at a time. Our thoughts are continually changing, but they are not random. What we think next depends on which direction we mentally move through a reference frame, in the same way that what we see next in a town depends on which direction we move from our current location. The reference frame needed to learn a coffee cup is perhaps obvious. It is the three-dimensional space around the cup. The reference frame learned in the fMRI experiment about birds is perhaps a bit less obvious, but the bird reference frame is still related to the physical attributes of birds, such as legs and necks. But what kind of reference frame should the brain use for concepts like economics or ecology? There may be multiple reference frames that work, although some may be better than others. This is one reason that learning conceptual knowledge can be difficult. If I give you 10 historical events related to democracy, how should you arrange them? One teacher might show the events arranged on a timeline. A timeline is a one-dimensional reference frame. It is useful for assessing the temporal order of events and which events might be causally related by temporal proximity. Another teacher might arrange the same historical events geographically on a map of the world. A map reference frame suggests different ways of thinking about the same events, such as which events might be causally related by spatial proximity to each other, or by proximity to oceans, deserts, or mountains. Timelines and geography are both valid ways of organizing historical events, yet they lead to different ways of thinking about history. They might lead to different conclusions and different predictions. The best structure for learning about democracy might require an entirely new map, a map with multiple abstract dimensions that correspond to fairness or rights. I am not suggesting that fairness or rights are actual dimensions used by the brain. My point is that becoming an expert in a field of study requires discovering a good framework to represent the associated data and facts. There may not be a correct reference frame, and two individuals might arrange the facts differently. Discovering a useful reference frame is the most difficult part of learning, even though most of the time we are not consciously aware of it. I will illustrate this idea with the three examples I mentioned earlier: mathematics, politics, and language. Mathematics. Say you are a mathematician and you want to prove the OMG conjecture. OMG is not a real conjecture. A conjecture is a mathematical statement that is believed to be true, but that has not been proven. To prove a conjecture, you start with something that is known to be true. Then you apply a series of mathematical operations. If, through this process, you arrive at a statement that is the conjecture, then you have succeeded in proving it. Typically, there will be a series of intermediate results. For example, starting from A, prove B. From B, prove C, and finally from C, prove OMG. Let's say A, B, C, and the final OMG are equations. To get from equation to equation, you have to perform one or more mathematical operations. Now let's suppose that the various equations are represented in your neocortex in a reference frame. Mathematical operations, such as multiply or divide, are movements that take you to different locations in this reference frame. Performing a series of operations moves you to a new location, a new equation. If you can determine a set of operations, movements through equation space, that gets you from A to OMG, then you have succeeded in proving OMG. Solving complex problems like a mathematical conjecture requires a lot of training. When learning a new field, your brain is not just storing facts. For mathematics, the brain must discover useful reference frames in which to store equations and numbers, and it must learn how mathematical behaviors, such as operations and transforms, move to new locations within the reference frames. To a mathematician, equations are familiar objects, similar to how you and I see a smartphone or a bicycle. When mathematicians see a new equation, they recognize it as similar to previous equations they have worked with, and this immediately suggests how they can manipulate the new equation to achieve certain results. It is the same process we go through if we see a new smartphone. We recognize the phone is similar to other phones we have used, and that suggests how we could manipulate the new phone to achieve a desired outcome. However, if you are not trained in mathematics, then equations and other mathematical notations will appear as meaningless scribbles. You may even recognize an equation as one you have seen before, but without a reference frame, you will have no idea how to manipulate it to solve a problem. You can be lost in math space in the same way you can be lost in the woods without a map. Mathematicians manipulating equations, explorers traveling through a forest, and fingers touching coffee cups all need map-like reference frames to know where they are and what movements they need to perform to get where they want to be. The same basic algorithm underlies these and countless other activities we perform. Politics. The above mathematical example is completely abstract, but the process is the same for any problem that isn't obviously physical. For example, say a politician wants to get a new law enacted. They have a first draft of the law written, but there are multiple steps required to get to the end goal of enactment. There are political obstacles along the way, so the politician thinks about all the different actions they might take. An expert politician knows what will likely happen if they hold a press conference, or force a referendum, or write a policy paper, or offer to trade support for another bill. A skilled politician has learned a reference frame for politics. Part of the reference frame is how political actions change locations in the reference frame. And the politician imagines what will happen if they do these things. Their goal is to find a series of actions that will lead them to the desired result, enacting the new law. A politician and a mathematician are not aware they are using reference frames to organize their knowledge, just as you and I are not aware that we use reference frames to understand smartphones and staplers. We don't go around asking, "Can someone suggest a reference frame for organizing these facts?" What we do say is, "I need help. I don't understand how to solve this problem." Or, "I'm confused. Can you show me how to use this thing?" Or, "I'm lost. Can you show me how to get to the cafeteria?" These are the questions we ask when we are not able to assign a reference frame to the facts in front of us. Language. Language is arguably the most important cognitive ability that distinguishes humans from all other animals. Without the ability to share knowledge and experiences via language, most of modern society would not be possible. Although many volumes have been written about language, I am not aware of any attempts to explain how language is created by the neural circuits observed in the brain. Linguists don't usually venture into neuroscience, and although some neuroscientists study brain regions related to language, they have been unable to propose detailed theories of how the brain creates and understands language. There is an ongoing debate as to whether language is fundamentally different from other cognitive abilities. Linguists tend to think so. They describe language as a unique capability, unlike anything else we do. If this were true, then the parts of the brain that create and understand language should look different. Here, the neuroscience is equivocal. There are two modest-sized regions of the neocortex that are said to be responsible for language. Wanneke's area is thought to be responsible for language comprehension, and Broca's area is thought to be responsible for language production. This is a bit of a simplification. First, there is a disagreement over the exact location and extent of these regions. Second, the functions of Wanneke's and Broca's areas are not neatly differentiated into comprehension and production. They overlap a bit. Finally, and this should be obvious, language can't be isolated to two small regions of the neocortex. We use spoken language, written language, and sign language. Wanneke's and Broca's areas don't get input directly from the sensors, so the comprehension of language must rely on auditory and visual regions, and the production of language must rely on different motor abilities. Large areas of the neocortex are needed to create and understand language. Wanneke's and Broca's areas play a key role, but it is wrong to think of them as creating language in isolation. A surprising thing about language, and one that suggests that language may be different than other cognitive functions, is that Broca's and Wanneke's areas are only on the left side of the brain. The equivalent areas on the right side are only marginally implicated in language. Almost everything else the neocortex does occurs on both sides of the brain. The unique asymmetry of language suggests there is something different about Broca's and Wanneke's areas. Why language only occurs on the left side of the brain might have a simple explanation. One proposal is that language requires fast processing, and neurons in most of the neocortex are too slow to process language. The neurons in Wanneke's and Broca's areas are known to have extra insulation, called myelin, that allows them to run faster and keep up with the demands of language. There are other noticeable differences with the rest of the neocortex. For example, it has been reported that the number and density of synapses is greater in the language regions compared to their equivalents on the right side of the brain. But having more synapses doesn't mean that the language areas perform a different function. It could just mean that these areas have learned more things. Although there are some differences, the anatomy of Wernicke's and Broca's areas is, once again, similar to other areas of the neocortex. The facts that we have today suggest that while these language areas are somewhat different, perhaps in subtle ways, the overall structure of layers, connectivity, and cell types is similar to the rest of the neocortex. Therefore, the majority of the mechanisms underlying language are likely shared with other parts of cognition and perception. This should be our working assumption until proven otherwise. Thus, we can ask, how could the modeling capabilities of a cortical column, including reference frames, provide a substrate for language? According to linguists, one of the defining attributes of language is its nested structure. For example, sentences are composed of phrases, phrases are composed of words, and words are composed of letters. Recursion, the ability to repeatedly apply a rule, is another defining attribute. Recursion allows sentences to be constructed with almost unlimited complexity. For example, the simple sentence, "Tom asked for more tea," can be extended to "Tom, who works at the auto shop, asked for more tea," which can be extended to "Tom, who works at the auto shop, the one by the thrift store, asked for more tea." The exact definition of recursion as it relates to language is debated, but the general idea is not hard to understand. Sentences can be composed of phrases, which can be composed of other phrases, and so on. It has long been argued that nested structure and recursion are key attributes of language. However, nested and recursive structure is not unique to language. In fact, everything in the world is composed this way. Take my coffee cup with the Numenta logo printed on the side. The cup has a nested structure. It consists of a cylinder, a handle, and a logo. The logo consists of a graphic and a word. The graphic is made up of circles and lines, while the word Numenta is composed of syllables, and the syllables are themselves made of letters. Objects can also have recursive structure. For example, imagine that the Numenta logo included a picture of a coffee cup, on which was printed a picture of the Numenta logo, which had a picture of a coffee cup, etc. Early on in our research, we realized that each cortical column had to be able to learn nested and recursive structure. This was a constraint necessary to learn the structure of physical things, like coffee cups, and to learn the structure of conceptual things, like mathematics and language. Any theories we came up with had to explain how columns do this. Imagine that sometime in the past you learned what a coffee cup looks like. And sometime in the past you learned what the Numenta logo looks like, but you had never seen the logo on a coffee cup. Now I show you a new coffee cup with the logo on the side. You can learn the new combined object quickly, usually with just one or two glances. Notice that you don't need to relearn the logo or the cup. Everything we know about cups and the logo is immediately included as part of the new object. How does this happen? Within a cortical column, the previously learned coffee cup is defined by a reference frame. The previously learned logo is also defined by a reference frame. To learn the coffee cup with the logo, the column creates a new reference frame in which it stores two things: a link to the reference frame of the previously learned cup and a link to the reference frame of the previously learned logo. The brain can do this rapidly with just a few additional synapses. This is a bit like using hyperlinks in a text document. Imagine I wrote a short essay about Abraham Lincoln, and I mentioned that he gave a famous speech called the Gettysburg Address. By turning the words Gettysburg Address into a link to the full speech, I can include all the details of the speech as part of my essay without having to retype it. Earlier, I said that cortical columns store features at locations in reference frames. The word feature is a bit vague. I will now be more precise. Cortical columns create reference frames for every object they know. Reference frames are then populated with links to other reference frames. The brain models the world using reference frames that are populated with reference frames. It is reference frames all the way down. In our 2019 Frameworks paper, we proposed how neurons might do this. We have a long way to go to fully understand everything the neocortex does, but the idea that every column models objects using reference frames is, as far as we know, consistent with the needs of language. Perhaps further down the road we will find a need for some special language circuits, but for now, that is not the case. Expertise. By now, I have introduced 4 uses for reference frames, 1 in the old brain and 3 in the neocortex. Reference frames in the old brain learn maps of environments. Reference frames in the what columns of the neocortex learn maps of physical objects. Reference frames in the where columns of the neocortex learn maps of the space around our body. And finally, reference frames in the non-sensory columns of the neocortex learn maps of concepts. To be an expert in any domain requires having a good reference frame, a good map. 2 people observing the same physical object will likely end up with similar maps. For example, it's hard to imagine how the brains of 2 people observing the same chair would arrange its features differently. But when thinking about concepts, 2 people starting with the same facts might end up with different reference frames. Recall the example of a list of historical facts. One person might arrange the facts on a timeline, and another might arrange them on a map. The same facts can lead to different models and different worldviews. Being an expert is mostly about finding a good reference frame to arrange facts and observations. Albert Einstein started with the same facts as his contemporaries. However, he found a better way to arrange them, a better reference frame that permitted him to see analogies and make predictions that were surprising. What is most fascinating about Einstein's discoveries related to special relativity is that the reference frames he used to make them were everyday objects. He thought about trains, people, and flashlights. He started with the empirical observations of scientists, such as the absolute speed of light, and used everyday reference frames to deduce the equations of special relativity. Because of this, almost anyone can follow his logic and understand how he made his discoveries. In contrast, Einstein's general theory of relativity required reference frames based on mathematical concepts called field equations, which are not easily related to everyday objects. Einstein found this much harder to understand, as does pretty much everyone else. In 1978, when Vernon Mountcastle proposed that there was a common algorithm underlying all perception and cognition, it was hard to imagine what algorithm could be powerful enough and general enough to fit the requirement. It was hard to imagine a single process that could explain everything we think of as intelligence, from basic sensory perception to the highest and most admired forms of intellectual ability. It is now clear to me that the common cortical algorithm is based on reference frames. Reference frames provide the substrate for learning the structure of the world, where things are, and how they move and change. Reference frames can do this not just for the physical objects that we can directly sense, but also for objects we cannot see or feel, and even for concepts that have no physical form. Your brain has 150,000 cortical columns. Each column is a learning machine. Each column learns a predictive model of its inputs by observing how they change over time. Columns don't know what they are learning. They don't know what their models represent. The entire enterprise and the resultant models are built on reference frames. The correct reference frame to understand how the brain works is reference frames.